On the morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 80 years later, all over the world, lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to the Chasing Earhart Podcast. Welcome back to the Chasing Earhart podcast and our continuing conversation with Chief Radio Man on the Itasca, Leo Bellarts. In episode 19, we continue talking with Leo about that fateful day in 1937 when Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. Leo continues his intimate and in-depth thoughts on what went wrong from the unique vantage point of the people that were on the other end of Amelia Earhart's radio. Continuing our multi-part retrospective interview, the Chasing Earhart team takes you back to 1973 and the home of Leo Bellarts, where he recalls the day that has gone down in history as the single greatest aviation mystery of all time.
Do you think she ever transmitted anything on 6210?
I think actually that's when she went. I actually think by the time she was shifting from one frequency to the other, I think that is exactly the time when she went into the drink.
So within a minute or two of that last radio transmission.
Just a minute or two, because she was overdue as far as her gasoline was concerned. She said she was low, you know.
Yeah, and that was over an hour earlier.
Well, that's it. That's it. How low is a different proposition. That's what Earl Gorner, he wrote to me, and he took exception to that 30-minute deal, too, see?
Yeah, and I think you probably know now how that got in there. So let's talk about the weather. Is there ever any indication of any kind of inclement weather or any kind of low cloud cover at that point in the flight?
The only thing that we heard here was at 0453, and that I copied that myself, and that's all you can hear is part cloudy.
Okay, gotcha. So not this cloudy and overcast kind of routine.
You know, just crash in on your ears. And I'll guarantee you that Hanslick and that other joker never heard that.
Yeah, because you'd probably be on the phones then at that point.
Absolutely. Not on no loudspeaker. You couldn't hear that. Because you was just fighting to get every breath, you know.
So up until that last transmission, her voice was really sort of quite calm and quite cool?
Very calm, cool, and collected, yes.
But then that last transmission, the pressure was on.
Boy, I'll tell you, I'll never forget her voice. You could hear her voice just starting to crack. You know how it is?
Have you ever heard recordings of her?
No.
And you don't really know if the guys on Howland or Baker Island ever heard her, correct?
No, they never heard her. They never heard her. We checked with them. We checked with them later. Quite some time when the old man was... And as far as that... Dwiggins, you know, saying that he used Captain Thompson's report. That's all repeat stuff. That's all repeat stuff. Captain was using his own vocabulary. You get the point?
Yes, sir.
He was using his own vocabulary, not exactly the way it was possibly on the log. He may have made a little change here and there using different English. See?
And certainly nothing against Captain Thompson. I hear from my records and from what I've been able to gather, he was certainly a fine officer.
I'll tell you one little story about Captain Thompson. We had a equator party, you know. And boy, when you have an equator party on a government ship, you really get it.
Ah, a little hazing going on there, maybe.
Oh, I hope to tell you. Anyway, we had a regular swimming tank built on the quarterdeck. The boys could go out and take a swim, you know, right on deck. Canvas with wood frame, and it was a nice little swimming tank. And that was the tank for the big shindig, King Neptune coming aboard and so forth. Well, I was a polywog, so I was going to be duly initiated, and the exec, Baker, he was also a polywog. And we got our shellacking, I mean it. The night before we went across the equator, I heard an awful rumpus out on the quarterdeck, and lo and behold, I went out there, and here they had the executive officer tied with his thumbs underneath the canopy on his toes, I mean, up on his toes like that. And they were scrubbing him down because they wanted the executive officer to be nice and clean when they crossed the equator. Believe me, they were scrubbing him down with deck scrubbers.
Oh, man, that's incredible.
Screaming bloody murder and having the best time of his life. So we had a pair of good officers on there, Thompson and Baker. Well, anyway, when we were going across the equator, they give me my due shellacking and so forth and so on. And the old man was walking up the side, you know, by the radio shack, and I had a pair of long phones on. We had a pair of phones, long cords that we could walk from one side of the shack to the other, you know, and still not take our phones off. And anyway, we had those things, and I was standing out just by the door, you know, and watching the goings on, and Captain Thompson was going up on the bridge. He says, "Oh, hello, Chief." He says, "Have you had any beer yet?" I says, "No." I says, "They got me pinned down here." "Oh, we'll take care of that." And there she was down in the berth deck, and they had some beer aboard, see? And here comes Captain Thompson in two mess cups, coffee cups, you know, out of general mess, two mugs of beer. He says, "Here you are, Chief." He says, "Have a couple of beers." And he went up on the bridge. That's the kind of a captain he was. Real aces. I mean it. He was a swell guy.
And from what I understand, he was pretty savvy, too.
He was. You bet your boots he was, yeah.
Now, Leo, can you talk a little bit about some of the broadcasts and some of the radio transmissions that reportedly had come from Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan later in the day and later in the evening? Can you sort of dispel some of that stuff from your point of view and talk a little bit about maybe where some of those might have come from?
I'll tell you what it is. We had several reports, and that is what Captain Thompson was confused on this Dwiggins letter, criminal, so forth, transmissions. Well, I know, because we sweated it out over some of those phony ones, and San Francisco office was no help. They was getting those reports too, and they was sending it out, and they actually was trying to direct our movements from San Francisco. They were crazy, actually nuts, trying to do that.
You go search here, you know, and you go do that.
Well, what it was, I believe the program was March of Time, or You Are There, or one of those comparable programs, you know, on radio. And they replayed Amelia Earhart's flight a day or so after that thing, and, "Oh yes, we hear, and some guy apparently got loose on a harmonic of that broadcast, and they actually thought that they was hearing Amelia Earhart on the radio. And it was a radio broadcast. And that really caused us some trouble out there, I believe. That is the way some of that stuff got, and possibly the Achilles has got in on that.
Well, it's interesting. The Achilles had sent a message. Supposedly, they had actually received a message from her, and they replied back with a message of their own. And in that message, they identified and they said, you know, "If you hear us, send a series of dashes." And then, you know, KHAQQ, KHAQQ, that's all they ever heard. And it seems now that it maybe had been somebody calling KHAQQ, KHAQQ, if you hear us, send a series of dashes.
And when something comes from a ship like the Achilles, I tend to take it a little more seriously.
Well, that's true. Yes. Because it wasn't directed to the Achilles. You know, they just heard it. And no telling where that doggone stuff comes from.
So you really hold to that 842, 843, whenever it was, that was the last time that anything signal-wise ever emanated from her airplane.
Absolutely right.
Now, you had met Fred Gerner on a few different occasions after the fact. Can you tell us a little bit about your meetings with Mr. Gerner?
I went down to San Francisco before he had this on the market, and we was corresponding. And when he was down there, when I got down there, I visited my son. He was in San Bruno. And Fred Gorner wanted to meet me, and I called him up, and he come out to San Bruno, and we sat there, my son and I and Fred, John, and talking. And I said, "Say, Fred," I says, "have you got your book? How far are you along on it?" "Oh," he says, "it's all finished." I said, "Well, good. I'll tell you something then." And I told him about the way we went out on that island and tried to slaughter those birds. We did. We killed hundreds of them, you know. I feel this way that Fred, in a nice way, I don't hold anything against him. He's wrote a book. You know, that he told me that the book was finished. So I kind of froze up on him a little bit.
Now, Leo, here's a practical question for you. How long were you aboard the Itasca?
As far as the Itasca is concerned, I went on her in February 15th, 1937, and I left it April 12th, 1938.
Wow, so you were on it for a year then, 1 year tour.
That's right, and before that I was on the Shawnee.
Oh, you were on the Shawnee before that.
Yeah, and after I left the Itasca, I went to the Northwind, which went to Alaska.
Okay, so according to the timeline, then, you were on the Itasca in February, and there's something that really doesn't have to do with anything relevant, but it's something I'm just curious about, and that is the general court-martial. Can you talk about that?
Oh, they tried to make a story out of that. There was nothing at all. What bothering you?
Oh, nothing. I don't know anything about it.
Well, you heard about it.
Well, I just saw references to it, you know, in the log. I didn't really know anything about her or know what it was about or who it was for or anything.
They tried to make a big thing out of it. You know, the court martial. Actually, what it was, we was on patrol, and we was told by San Francisco to put in at San Pedro. We was based in San Diego, see, and to put in San Pedro. To convene a general court-martial. Well, there was not enough officers at San Pedro Base to conduct a general court-martial, so they told us to go in and use some of our officers to hold the general court. They tried to say that the chief boatswain's mate on the Itasca was drunk on duty or something. Well, I don't know what the charge was against the chief boatswain's mate, but I know the chief boatswain's mate on the Itasca, I don't think he ever took a drink in his life.
So it had nothing to do with the Itasca at all. It was just being, I guess some of the officers were just being utilized.
Just use the officers, that's all. Nothing else at all.
You know, I'm just curious, do you remember at all how much total wattage your transmitters were putting out?
Oh, I don't know, a couple hundred watts at least.
A couple hundred watts at least, huh?
I don't remember what it was. We could control it, you know, up or down. We had more than ample power, let's put it that way.
Were people hearing you at all? I mean, Honolulu and Tutia, I mean, at least on the 3105 and the 6210.
We didn't really check on that, but I know this. That on 3105, we was heard in the Midwest.
At some different, whenever the skip was right, I imagine.
Well, I mean, while we was working out there, some hams was, what was it, Colorado, Utah, some dog.
Well, I guess, I mean, what, you know, if they were hearing you, that must mean that the skip was right. But, I mean, they weren't hearing Earhart, so that was just because of maybe your radiated power. And everybody must have been listening on the right frequency if they were hearing you. I mean, I guess all this gets down to is that she must have been really close to you. I mean, I'm just trying to tie this down.
Honestly, I'll tell you the fact. I actually got outside the shack and listened like that. And for a couple of minutes, I went up on the bridge. Galton took over or something. I don't remember. I know I was on the bridge, and the guys on the bridge, you know, on the flying bridge, they was out there actually listening for her. That's how close I thought she was, really. Really, I thought she was going to fly right down in on our antennas. We even worked in for crying's sakes. Gee whiz.
Well, she was that close when she said, "I must be on you but cannot see you." And you say that she was almost at the same exact signal strength on that last transmission.
She couldn't hardly get any louder.
She was almost blocking your receiver.
That's right. I had quite a bit of experience as far as plane monitoring, because before I went to the Itasca, I was at Point Vicente, and we used to be plane guard down there at Point Vicente for these planes out of San Diego. Every time a plane would take off from San Diego, we would set plane guard on him. They used to come over Point Vicente and wave at us, you know, wave their wings, so to speak, and they'd fly right over us.
Leo, I wonder if you would talk a little bit about maybe some of the untold stories and maybe some of the old untold things. Is there anything in your eyes that really was never told, or in your eyes should never be told? Will we ever have the whole story of what happened that day?
Just as Fred Gorner says, someday everybody will know everything. Well, there's still some things that has nothing to do with the flight, really, you know, the outcome of it, but a personal history, let's put it that way, that will go in with it. And actually, I don't think one or two things should be ever published as long as there's anybody alive that was ever on that ship. No reflection on the officers or crew directly, you know, but it would be embarrassing, let's put it that way. One thing, you know, we was out there at Howland. Actually, we left Howland and went down to Baker for a day, not very far. Turned around, came back, supplied that base. Waiting for her to take off. And she wouldn't give us any information at all, no advance information. And I guess Thompson was a little bit disgusted. I know I've heard it, but it didn't come from me. And now in my later years, let's put it that way.
And this really boils down and comes all the way back to the preparation of these reports, the communications, the logs, and everything else, and everyone involved. It seems that everybody would have to be in on it. If, in fact, Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan were nowhere near Howland Island. So really, all the right people would have to be in the know. Am I understanding that correct?
Well, if you take a chart of that area, if you take a chart of that area and look at Ley, New Guinea, where Howland Island is at, and where Saipan is at, and check on how many miles it is from Ley, New Guinea, the time of the, well, the advancement, I'd say, of aerial photography in them days, 1937. I don't think they had these infrared cameras at that time. When Amelia Earhart left, where was she at? And where was she at in daytime? It's a physical impossibility that she was on a cloak and dagger thing, because she would be flying over Saipan, Truk, or any other island over there at night. And you, in them days, you didn't take pictures. At least I don't think you did. And when it was daylight, she was practically out, east of the Gilberts, actually, so to speak. Here we are. Port Darwin was asked if she would use the radio transmitter facility. She told the officials that her direction finder was not working. Miss Earhart's radio equipment was not checked out, only her direction finder. Now, there's some more cockeyed information.
Well, now, her direction finder, there was a sergeant, and I forget his name, but he found that there was a blown fuse, and he replaced the fuse, and he gave her two spares.
Sergeant, Army Sergeant Stan Rose, checked her direction finder and discovered that the fuse had blown after replacing the fuse and so forth. Here is here. And it says also it would change the wavelength at nightfall. Balfour, the guy you read from letters from here, advised them just before night fell not to change their signals. We're coming in quite strong and so forth.
They couldn't have been that close to you and been towards the southeast, because then they would have run into Baker Island.
Baker Island, I tell you, was just as bad as Howland, maybe worse, as far as flying over. I tell you, you could fly within 10 miles of those islands and you couldn't see them. I tell you, they're only that far above the water, you know. I don't know a heck of a lot about flying. I never got off the ground until after I was over 60 years old.
Well, it's interesting, and people have argued that, you know, flying at 1,000 feet, 1,200 feet, in that range, you wouldn't be able to see those islands from 10, 12 miles out. You'd have to be right on top of them, but you could certainly see the smoke that you guys would have laid down at that time.
A ship don't smoke like that unless they have to, you know, unless they call for it. Because I was actually aboard ship, and I heard the bridge say, make smoke. And boy, I tell you, when they want to make smoke, they can lay down a smoke screen. You know how you've seen pictures of during sea battles.
Now, Leo, if you don't mind, I'd like to take a little bit of time and take the radio log that you made. Matter of fact, I'd like to use your actual log during those critical few hours and just sort of go over it line by line and just sort of work some of the highlights of that and explain to folks who are listening exactly what that log entails. So let's start, July 2nd here. Let's start here. Nothing heard from Earhart. Sent weather at 30. AAA. Now, she asked you to send a series of A's, didn't she?
That was in our preliminary report. You see, this was made up actually for the Shoshone originally. The Shoshone was supposed to go down there originally, and then there was a accident, I believe, on wherever it was, and then they turned it around and she went around the other way. Well, we just substituted Itasca for Shoshone, and actually those reports or requests was made long before we even left, and they supplied us with all that written information at Honolulu when we got there.
Oh, I see.
And we were supposed to send these A's for her identification. And I think, what was it, the Ontario and Swan, they were supposed to send out signals.
Yeah, the Ontario was supposed to send out ends on 400 kilocycles. You know, it's interesting, she wanted you to transmit on 7,500 kilocycles, and she wanted the Ontario to send on 400 kilocycles. And interestingly enough, she wanted the Swan to send on either 9,000 kilocycles or 900 kilocycles if 9,000 wasn't working properly. Now, there's a certain logic to it. She knew she was going to be flying over the Ontario at night, so she said 400 kilocycles for that. And then she knew she was going to be coming into you during the daytime, so she said 7,500 kilocycles. But with the Swan, she didn't know if she was going to be flying into the Swan either day or night, so she said 9,000 kilocycles. Or, if that's not feasible, then 900 kilocycles, which is, if I'm not mistaken, right in the middle of broadcast band, which I'm not sure if you can even transmit on that band or not. But the bottom line is there seems to be a certain logic to her, a method to her madness there.
I didn't get that 9,000 or 900. I don't recall that.
And there's a certain logic to that. Somebody had sold her a bill of goods on a high-frequency direction finding. Somebody who, at the time, didn't really know what they were talking about. It was all theory, and it wasn't put into practice yet. Because as you and I know, and most of the folks listening out there know, with direction finding, the lower, the better. And the best, you know, frequency of all, really, is about 500 kilocycles. And once you get up over 2 megacycles, direction finding becomes a little more, or a little less accurate. But nevertheless, she got sold a real bill of goods on this HF direction finding. And that's why she had the Itasca on 7,500, because somebody told her that 500 is no good. They had told her that 500 is just for a few miles, and for the 7,500, they had told her that, you know, this could be picked up 1,000 miles away. Okay, so continuing along here, here we are. Repeat weather on phone 3105. Now, repeat weather, you sent weather on 30, and that was on 7,500. Now, did you guys send the weather on phone?
We repeated it. We sent no weather by key. It was all voice. We knew her capabilities.
Okay, continuing on here. At 45, Earhart heard phone. We'll listen on hour and half. On 3105, says she. You know, reading over the log, I can tell who's on because certain people, like Galton, has a habit of saying smoke. Like, you know, no smoke. So whenever I see no smoke, I know Galton's on watch.
You can tell by the signature. See, mine's, I got a signature here down here. It says LG Bell Arts off to Galton. Actually,
now, you're sitting there at your station with the earphones on. You had the mill right in front of you. And this was actually done as you heard it. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of the radio operators at that time were taught in such a way where they would, when a message would come in, they would copy down the message, and then when they were done copying it, they would look up and they would see what time it was on the clock. And then after that, you would estimate how long you took taking down the message. So if the message came in, or if you stopped taking the message at 11:15, let's say, you would look at it and you would say, oh, it came in at 11:10. You would estimate that it was took you about 5 minutes to take that message, and so you would estimate that it came in about 5 minutes ago, so in this case, 11:15 backwards to 11:10. So how did you guys arrive at the time when you did, when you took your messages on the Itasca?
At the completion. If you'll notice, it, at the start of this thing, I started it at 1900. Watch started at blank blank, 1900, and then I make the notation, signals heard logged only. In other words, I'm logging only the signals that I hear. If I don't hear anything, I don't fill up the doggone paper with no sigs, no sigs, no sigs.
Now, what does this 45 slant 4 dash dash mean? This is at 0345, Earhart heard.
That's just, I just made the remark that I heard Earhart. The only thing that I could hear or understand is that she will listen on the hour and a half hour on 3105. She says, or says she. See, I'm repeating what she said, and that's all I could understand.
Oh, I see. So at that time, she would still be approximately 600 miles off.
That's right.
Okay, so now then you start broadcasting the weather again, this time at 0400. You broadcast the weather on phone at 3105, and then you repeated the weather on key on 3105. And we move on, Earhart unheard from 1518. They broadcast weather on key and on phone 30 to 35. Now, when you say the weather on key and phone, do you mean both on 7500 kilocycles and 3105? Or just 3105, or do you know?
3105. The AAs, if I recall rightly, the AAs was on 7500. That's what we was using for her beacon. We used no CW with her ATOL.
Sent weather code phone 3105. And heard Earhart. Now, you heard Earhart at 0500 or 453?
0453.
Okay, and you, now, why is that dashed line there?
Because I dashed it out and I made a mistake and I dropped it down. That part cloudy was still, that was correct. That part cloudy should not have been crossed out the way it is. I just spaced it out like that by mistake.
Okay, so you heard Earhart, and all the words you can make out were just part cloudy.
That's right.
Okay, continuing on here, at 1518, Earhart unheard.
And that's, you see, she said she was going to listen on the hour and a half hour.
Okay, sent weather, code and key on 3105, sent at 0600 and 0605. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Wants bearing on 3105 on the hour. Wants bearing on 3105 kilocycles. Will whistle and Mike, and that came in at 0614.
And actually, here is a key right here. She wanted a bearing on 3105, and she said she wanted it on the hour, and that she would whistle in the microphone. Mm-hmm. You notice that's at 0614.
Uh-huh.
And she says on the hour, and here it was 14 minutes after the hour. 1 minute later, she comes on. And she says, we're about 200 miles out, approximately. And she was not whistling. I put down whistle because she said it was whistling. Actually, it was an audible sound. That's what she was doing. She was just, it was a whistle I've never heard before. It was actually a shrill note. like that. That's what she was doing. We could have handled it, but notice when she did that. 1 minute after she asked on the hour.
I'm Chris Williamson, and you've been listening to the Chasing Earhart podcast. You can follow the project online using the handle @ChasingEarhart. If you haven't had the chance yet, please go to Apple Podcast and subscribe, review, and rate this podcast. Join me next week for the final segment of our conversation with Leo Bellarts. Thanks for listening.